The new fall TV season is around the corner, and some new shows are already jumping the gun and offering early premieres this week. TV critic David Bianculli gives a broad overview of what to expect and what not to miss. His overall assessment isn't that optimistic.
For the second year in a row, the new shows served up by the broadcast TV networks are dull and disappointing. Not a great new program in the bunch. There are a pair of terrific new series on the horizon, on cable. But the entire fall TV season concept has been defined and dominated by broadcast television for half a century now. And though that changes a little each year, it's still the biggest game in town with the most viewers and the most attention. So here we go again. On broadcast TV this season, the biggest excitement, for the most part, is generated by changes to some returning shows, all of them on CBS. The network is so certain of a growing audience for The Good Wife, especially against pro football, that it's moving that drama series from Tuesdays to Sundays. There are high-profile changes in leading men, too. Ashton Kutcher, hoping to keep Two and a Half Men going after Charlie Sheen and that sitcom parted ways, is guaranteed must-see TV, at least for week one. CBS hasn't shown that to critics yet, but it did give us a taste of Ted Danson as the newest star of the original CSI crime scene investigation. And judging from only one brief but tender and funny scene, Danson looks like the best replacement hire on a TV drama since Jimmy Smits took over for David Caruso on NYPD Blue. All three of those changes will take effect the week of September 19th when the 2011 TV season begins officially. Unofficially, though, it starts this week, with NBC premiering two new comedies and the CW network unveiling three new shows. Of the five, easily the best is CW's Ringer, a drama premiering Tuesday night. It marks the return to TV of Sarah Michelle Gellar of Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame. She plays a dual role, portraying both Bridget, an ex-stripper on the run, and Siobhan, her rich and pampered sister with her own dangerous secrets. In the pilot, these identical twins meet after 6 years apart, as Siobhan welcomes Bridget for a secret reunion at her opulent beach house.
This is our weekend place.
Make yourself at home. Looks just like my house. Except not at all. Your life seems perfect.
Close to it, but no one's life is perfect. So, it's just the two of us this weekend.
Where's Andrew?
He's in London, working.
Then visiting Juliet at boarding school.
So, how long have you guys been married?
Almost 5 years.
Bridget, Andrew doesn't exactly know about you.
About my visiting?
About your existing. He doesn't know I have a sister.
If that clip leaves you intrigued but not overwhelmed, join the club. That's my reaction to a handful of new series this year. They aren't bad, but I sure wish they were better. That said, here are the broadcast TV shows to remember and sample as the fall season rolls out this month and next. New Girl is a Fox comedy starring Zooey Deschanel as a young girl who moves in with three guys, platonically at least at first, after a painful romantic breakup. The pilot's not that endearing, but the actress certainly is. Once Upon a Time is a high-concept ABC fantasy about fairy tale characters who are put under a spell and banished to our world with their memories removed. What makes this interesting is that it comes from the network owned by Disney, so its Snow White and other characters get very close to the iconic animated versions with no fear of a lawsuit. We haven't seen X Factor yet, but since that Fox competition show marks the return of both Simon Cowell and Paula Abdul, I wouldn't bet against it. However, despite the name of Steven Spielberg behind another Fox series, Terra Nova, I might bet against that one, even though I'll keep an eye on it for a while. Its premise is classic sci-fi. People in the future escape from a toxic Earth by time-traveling back to prehistoric days and setting up camp. The CGI dinosaurs are cool and seem real. The human characters, not so much. Period dramas are big this year because of Mad Men. And while NBC's Playboy Club is horrible, ABC's Pan Am, starring Christina Ricci, is slicker, smarter, and a lot more watchable. I'd give that a try. And the same goes for NBC's remake of Prime Suspect, starring Maria Bello in a cop show inspired by the fabulous British program starring Helen Mirren. The new show itself isn't bad, but it's got almost nothing to do with the original Prime Suspect. So much so that using the title almost amounts to false advertising. In any event, it's an infinitely better remake than ABC's remake of Charlie's Angels, one of the worst new shows of the season. And that's in a season with Hader on CW and I Hate My Teenage Daughter on Fox. I hate them all. They're the worst. But what about the best? In October, two new shows are coming that you absolutely must watch. But they're coming on cable. One is Showtime's Homeland, which stars Damian Lewis from Band of Brothers and Life. He plays an American POW rescued after years of captivity. He returns as a hero, but a CIA agent played by Claire Danes suspects him of having been turned and actually being a double agent for Al-Qaeda. Only one of them is the real hero of this series, and for a while at least, we don't know which. This unusual drama comes from some of the producers of 24, and the pilot is wonderful. Also unusual and wonderful is the new FX series American Horror Story, which may be the scariest TV show I've ever seen. It's about a couple who tries to save their marriage by moving across the country, but unfortunately, they move into a house with a history of being haunted. It's from the team behind Glee and Nip Tuck, and it's got an unbelievably talented cast. Connie Britton from Friday Night Lights as the wife, Dylan McDermott from The Practice as the husband, Frances Conroy from 6 Feet Under as the housekeeper, and, as the spooky neighbor, Jessica Lange. 1 month from now, my guess is that you'll be talking about both those shows. And another guess, a month from now, you won't be talking about most of the other TV shows about to premiere. But be patient. Good stuff is on the way.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. I sometimes end the show with news about people we work with. It's usually great news, like the birth of a baby or someone leaving for an exciting new job. Today, the news is not good. Our former colleague, Nessa Foreman, died over the weekend of pancreatic cancer. She was WHYY's Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs from 1983 to 2007. I'm grateful that I got to work with her and know her. Nessa was enormously helpful when Fresh Air made the transition from a local to a national program, and she bailed me out of a couple of tough spots over the years. But more important, she was a person who cared about the station, its programs, the audience it served, and the people she worked with. I'm one of the very, very many people who will miss her. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
So today is the last day of New York Fashion Week, that twice-yearly ritual where retailers and editors decide what they think we want to buy in the spring. To give us a peek, we spoke with Sally Singer. She's the editor-in-chief of T, the New York Times style magazine, and she joined us from our New York bureau. Sally, good morning.
Good morning.
So what are the trends in fashion you're seeing? What is my wife going to be telling me that she wishes she could buy next spring?
Next spring, your wife is going to want to wear a print, is what the New York designers are saying. In fact, she might want to wear three prints, and there might be like a neon streak in them somewhere. Certainly more whimsical than we've seen fashion in some time.
Whimsical prints. Why does fashion seem to be going in that direction with women's clothing heading to the spring?
I think it's a few things. We saw in Europe for the fall some wonderful prints of pansies and cats and dogs and the like. So you have a surge out of Europe for print and color. That's one thing. On the other thing is that we've been in a pretty minimal period. And, you know, that plays itself out with the retailers. A woman only needs so many pairs of chic black pants or so many cream jackets. What does she need now? She needs a dress covered in birds. And or that's the hope.
Well, what's the mood of the retailers who are sitting out there in the audience with you?
You know, I feel this season they seem upbeat. I mean, cautiously upbeat.
Sure.
But more upbeat than I've seen in a while. It might be that they've seen, and I hear this, that those who have money seem to be shopping and seem to be consuming in a way that might be out of step with what we've just read on the front page of the paper, that the poverty rates are the highest they've been in decades, I think. So it just might be that the top end of retail is sustaining itself, which is exciting for the retailers who sit at the shows because they know that what they're buying from these shows will get to somebody.
So some of the brands that are at these shows are certainly familiar to our audience. I mean, big American designers, Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger. Who are the young designers who are going to be those future Calvins and Tommies?
Well, I think this week so far, we've really seen a new generation emerge who have the capacity, the drive, the sort of at oneness with their customer to build those sorts of brands. There's Alexander Wang, who's still exceedingly young. I don't even know if he's 25 yet. He is the go-to person for skinny, sporty, techno-y, hipster chic. And his show was a fantastic exercise in branding. And it wasn't a show about the future of fashion and direction and couture. It was a show about how kids want to look right now. Rag & Bone, same thing. Two guys, British, fantastic line. Started by doing Made in America jeans and shirts for men. Now they have a full line that, again, has everything from the sunglass to the shoe, speaks to a generation that loved rave culture, that likes a bit of historicism and nostalgia. And I would say the third would be Olivier Teskins, who made his name doing exceedingly beautiful ball gowns in Paris. He now has a line for Theory called Teskins Theory. It's like a baggy dropped crotch trouser and layered tailored jackets. And when you saw it, you thought, I need all those clothes in my closet. And they cost usually under $700, which still is a lot of money. I absolutely grant you that, but isn't $7,000.
But sounds like the headline from Fashion Week is women get ready for print season next spring.
Or print exhaustion.
Print exhaustion. That's Sally Singer, who is editor-in-chief of T, the New York Times style magazine. Sally, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a moment, the Latin Grammy Awards are coming up. We'll find out what's hot and popping in the world of Spanish and Portuguese language song. Please stay with us for that. But first, to a subject that's just as entertaining and competitive, Fashion Week. Top designers have been showing off their spring 2012 collections at the Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week in New York. We're talking about Michael Kors, Tracy Reese, Vera Wang, Marc Jacobs, so many more. The event is huge for designers seeking to influence our image in the months ahead. Fashion Week is just wrapping up, so we've called on someone who's taken it all in. Robin Gavan is a special correspondent for style and culture at Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Welcome back. So good to talk to you once again.
It's great to be here.
So first, before we get into the shows, we were reminded that Fashion Week had just started off when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And we've been thinking about and observing the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I did want to ask whether that affected the mood and the atmosphere in any way.
You know, in many ways, a lot of the news recently in fashion has been about this new generation of designers. And one of the sort of ironic things is that that generation really sort of coalesced because of 9/11. Their shows were canceled, and the industry sort of banded together to give them a place to show those collections as a group. But just for the shows that were on that day, certainly there were acknowledgments. So, I mean, it was very much on the minds of the people who were presenting their collection. And I think they were trying to be both respectful, but also move forward.
Speaking of moving forward, now to the trends.
Yeah.
What caught your eye?
There is so much color on the runway, so much bold print and pattern. It's like blossoms of flowers. And it's just extraordinarily cheerful.
Did anything... I just have to put it this way. Was there anything that just made you go, yuck?
Well, it wouldn't be Fashion Week unless there were a few moments like that. One of the most curious shows, I will say, was from Donna Karan. She is an incredibly talented designer. She was inspired this time by Africa, by her interest in Haiti, where she's been extremely involved in philanthropy. But, you know, sometimes when designers sort of go off to far-flung lands, they tend to come back with more cliches than inspiration. There were definitely moments when you sort of thought, really? Do I need this much mud cloth in my life? I don't think so.
Okay. But overall, though, are the clothes things that lots of people could imagine wearing as opposed to just like three people?
I think there's a lot there for a wide variety of people. And the reason I say that is because there's a lot of sort of slouchiness and comfort that's really being injected into the clothes. And they're pretty.
Is there one signature piece or something that, if you're on a budget, and who isn't these days, is there one signature piece or trend that you think would be great to pick up on to feel like you're...
In the mix?
In the mix.
I would say just inject a little bit of color into that black, the camel, the white, the gray. And I think people will just sort of be in a better mood for doing it.
Okay. Speaking of intense bursts of color, one of the things that turned...
That was a good segue.
One of the headlines, one of the things that turned heads, or I should say people who turned heads were not actually on the runway. Rapper Nicki Minaj was spotted sitting with Anna Wintour, who is, she's basically like the queen, right? She's the editor-in-chief of American Vogue.
Right.
They attended two shows together, one by Carolina Herrera and one by Oscar de la Renta. They are like the ones, you know, the people that dress the Kennedys and people like that. And Nicki Minaj, for people who aren't as familiar with her very unique style, we're talking like Marie Antoinette wigs. We're talking like she had this one shirt that looked like it was made of puffballs or something.
You know, it's a cartoon. And there's a long history in fashion of Anna Wintour being very savvy about recognizing who these young players are. So she really sees where popular culture is going.
We're talking about Fashion Week. It's wrapping up in New York. We're joined by Robin Givhan. She's the special correspondent for Style and Culture for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. I just thought I'd mention that. One of the most anticipated events of the week was the launch of Mazzoni's limited edition line for Target, Mazzoni being the Italian knitwear designer and manufacturer. Do I have this right that the Target's website actually shut down and that in some of the stores the entire delivery was sold out in like 20 minutes?
The website did crash. And in New York, before the merchandise made it to the website and was sort of filtered out into the stores, there was a pop-up store. It was scheduled to be open for 3 days. It was open for approximately 6 hours before all of the merchandise sold out.
Oh, my goodness.
Target is known for doing these limited edition designer collaborations. And none of them have had the kind of buzz that this has. Missoni is all about color, print, and those just vibrant zigzag patterns. And you can take that idea and translate it from a t-shirt to a patio umbrella. And the moment is also right for that because, as I was saying, it's a moment of color and pattern. And it's one of those names that's been around for such a long time. It's out there in the culture, and it's really accessible.
And finally, before we let you go, I wanted to talk about an article that you wrote that appeared in this month's issue of Essence magazine.
Yeah.
And you talked about that there's, in fact, a fairly small number of black designers who are considered top names. So is it that the dial hasn't moved at all or that it's, in fact, worse?
I don't think that they've necessarily gotten worse. I think what's happened is that the industry has grown exponentially. And so at a time when, you know, the names like Patrick Kelly and Willie Smith, you know, were out there, the industry was much smaller. What's happened, though, is that there are so few black students going to design school. And so they're just not in the pipeline.
Why do you think that is?
You know, the reasons are sort of complex. I mean, one of the most surprising was that both students and, you know, folks who work in admissions talked about the fact that a lot of black students who are sort of academically able, their parents do not steer them to design school, to creative professions. In fact, they steer them away. And then the third thing that was quite interesting was just simply that the decline in arts education in public schools. And when you don't have arts literate teachers in high school, you don't have people saying, hey, this hobby could actually be a career.
But what do you think is lost? I guess the question I have is, why should people care?
just in a very broad sense, we should care because fashion is a creative field. And then just in terms of dollars and cents, African Americans consume an enormous amount of fashion and inspire an enormous amount of fashion. So it would be nice to also see them economically benefiting from that impact.
Robin Kavan is a special correspondent for Style and Culture for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. She also penned an article for this month's Essence magazine about the state of blacks in design. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Robin Kavan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And in tribute to Hispanic Heritage Month, we decided to focus on one of the things that sustains the culture no matter the nationality, music. Yesterday, nominees for this year's Latin Grammy Awards were announced. Winners will be announced at the awards program November 10th in Las Vegas. But joining us to talk about some of the exciting nominations are Jasmine Garst and Felix Contreras. They are co-hosts of NPR Music's Alt Latino. That's an online program about Latin alternative music. Welcome back to you both. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So excited to be here.
So, Jasmine, tell us about what are some of the nominations that are causing the most buzz.
Well, definitely we have to talk about Puerto Rican rap duo Calle 13. They have a record-breaking 10 nominations for their album Entren Los Que Quieran. And, Michelle, I just want to play a song for you. This is...
Just for me.
Yes, just for you. Okay. This is Latino America.
Okay, here it is. Let's hear it. Tú no puedes comprar el viento. Tú no puedes comprar el sol. Comprar la lluvia, tú no puedes comprar el calor, tú no puedes comprar las nubes, tú no puedes comprar los colores, tú no puedes comprar mi alegría, tú no puedes comprar mis dolores. So this song was nominated for Song of the Year. And they also were nominated for Best Urban Music Album. What is it that, what do you think that's, first of all, you got to help me translate. Translate. What are they talking about? And then tell us, what is it that the industry is so excited about?
It's a beautiful ode to Latin America. And it's featuring, one of the things I love about Calle 13 is they work a lot with legendary artists. And this the hook that you're hearing is sung by Colombian folk singer Toto La Mombocina. She's a legendary Colombian songstress. And this album was just fantastic. I mean, I really like reggaeton and I like Latin rap a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that's coming out is eh, but Calle 13 just makes it worth giving Latin rap a chance. Their lyrics are intelligent and raunchy and funny and good. They're just good. The music that they hook with is really awesome. And they have so much passion. And this album was just very passionate. A lot of it reads like an ode to Latin America.
Just, could you just translate a little bit?
Sure. They're just talking about, you know, who they are. You know, I am the backbone of Latin America. You know, for example, they say, I am the face of somebody who has disappeared. So they just go through all of what, every single Latin experience, and they put it in a
poem. A lot
of
history.
Yeah.
It's actually woven through very poetically. Mm-hmm. Okay. Felix, anything surprising this time around? Any head scratchers?
Well, those guys were surprising in the sense that they won a record-setting 10 nominations for that album and a number of singles that came out of it. Like Jasmine says, they're both profound and profane, and there's a lesson to be learned, I think, from other musicians who go the profane way to balance it. So that was, to me, that was surprising that the industry was giving them that kind of recognition. Another thing that was interesting to me was in the Best Tango category, there was a flamenco singer nominated. And it's interesting because it's a cross-genre type of thing. It's as if John Legend made a bluegrass album and killed.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, do we have some? Can you play a little bit?
Yeah, we're
going to
play a thing called...
El Día Que Me Quieras.
That one.
El día que me quiera, la rosa que engalana, te ve tiran de fiesta, con su mejor. La campana dirán que no eres mía y loca la fontana le brindarán su amor.
And this is
Diego El Cigala.
This is beautiful. Why is this surprising?
Because it's flamenco is a very insular kind of music. There's very strong characteristics that make a great flamenco singer. And Sigala is considered one of the greatest. He's of the younger generation, so he's considered an up-and-coming master. And to use those things that he does in flamenco, some of the vocal trills, some of those traditions that go back hundreds of years, and to superimpose them over a completely different genre and style and practice of tango, it works effortlessly. It's just a nice combination.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about this year's Latin Grammy nominations with the host of NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast, Jasmine Garst and Felix Contreras. Well, what about, are there other classical artists or established artists that got a nod this year? I think many people who follow the English Grammys will remember when Herbie Hancock won for, I think it was for Best Album, and people were like, what?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I think we should mention Vicente Fernandez. He is a remarkable artist who has been nominated. He's 71 years old. He has 35 plus years of career. And he does a lot of like mariachi, ranchera style, very rural. And despite that he's been critically acclaimed, he's sold 50 million albums in his career. He's already won one Grammy in 2010, and this is possibly the second time.
What is the category?
This is the best ranchero album, and that's under the field of Mexican regional. This is ranchero style. This is very mariachi. We'll play it, and then I'll explain.
Okay, here it is.
No sé qué tienen tus ojos benditos. Para mí son medicina que curan penas y heridas que al paso del tiempo me fue dejando la vida.
Michelle, be careful. Felix is getting restless. I think he wants to get down on one knee and start singing.
And this is Tu Mirada. And tell us a little bit more.
It's mariachi, obviously. It's
dance music, isn't it?
It's dance music. It's, you know, I've heard some people refer to it as Mexican restaurant music because that's what
you
hear. I know.
That's cold.
But I've seen some great mariachis in restaurants sometimes. But it is a traditional style. It's a very rural style. It's reflecting a way of life that used to be in Mexico and that some people still wish there were, even the city dwellers. They always have a soft spot in their heart for mariachi music, just simply because of what it represents and its history. And Vicente Fernandez is the gold standard of mariachi singers. Everybody else is compared to him.
Felix, one thing I wanted to ask you about, this is something that you did a story about, and we've been talking about the Latin Grammys, which is, of course, for artists who perform and record in Spanish and Portuguese. But earlier this year, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, which is the group that's in charge of the English language Grammys, eliminated 31 categories, including Latin jazz. Now, is that having repercussions for the Latin Grammys? For example, are artists who previously would have competed in that category, do they have a home in the Latin Grammys? Is Latin jazz represented anywhere?
It's represented within the Latin Grammys, for sure. You know, the Latin Grammys are controversial among some of the artists, among the Latin artists, because some of them, and talking to a lot of Latin jazz artists, they feel like the Latin Grammys are sort of a separate but equal type of thing. And they want to be able to compete within the Grammys in general so that there's a whole, it's an even playing field. Not every artist feels that way. A lot of these artists that I've talked to are saying, you know, with the rise of the Hispanic culture, Latino culture here in the United States, for NARIS to eliminate that category and have us compete against Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, et cetera, it's an uneven playing field.
Well, what couldn't one argue the other way, that aren't there a lot of artists who record in English or both in English and Spanish who are left out by the rubric of only recording in Spanish and Portuguese? I mean, isn't there a whole like generation of artists with Latin American heritage?
Yeah.
It's interesting because, I mean, one of the in order to be considered for a Latin Grammy, 51% of the lyrics have to be in Spanish or in Portuguese. But at the same time, we talk on our show all the time about how many Latin artists choose to sing in English for marketing reasons or just because they want to. And it's really, I mean, it's an interesting question to consider. I mean, where do you draw that line?
All right. We'll meet again in November when the awards are announced, and you can tell us if there are any upsets and any head scratchers.
We look forward to it.
Felix Contreras and Jasmine Garst are co-hosts of NPR Music's Alt Latino. That's a podcast that explores Latin alternative music. And you can hear them at npr.org/altlatino. Jasmine, Felix, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks
for having us.